Take a network break. It's almost time for back to school, so get your pencil case and your trapper keeper and join us for this week's review of tech news. I'm Drew Conry Murray, and with me is Greg Farrow. Before we tackle this week's news, I want to thank our sponsors. Network Breaks being brought to you in part by CloudGenix, which is hosting an SD-WAN mixer with the Packet Pushers at VMworld 2016. You can meet the Packet Pushers live, enjoy free food and drinks, and find out what an SD-WAN application-defined branch looks like. See CloudGenix.com for more details and to register for the event. And thanks to Nuage Networks, let Nuage Networks make your data center network as responsive as your business needs to be. Find out how their software-defined networking solutions will transform your data center network so it can keep pace with your business. Visit nuagenetworks.net and join the cloud conversation on Twitter using @NuageNetworks. All right, let's jump into the news. Starting off with Arista, they announced a new telemetry platform. Greg, you wrote that up, actually.
Yeah, yes, I wrote a blog post on Packet Pushers this week about Arista's telemetry platform. I received a PDF from them, which sort of explains it. And there's a couple of things about the telemetry platform that I thought were quite interesting. First of all, I like its openness. It's based on moderately standard open protocols like NetConf, Yang, gRPC, and so forth. We've talked about those plenty of times in the past. But Arista hasn't actually excluded you from other products. So I see this as a framework as opposed to a platform, right? I've talked in the past that, you know, platforms say products like Cisco's ACI and NSX, they don't allow you to scale laterally. You buy them and then everything that, once you're using those products, everything has to sit on top of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, when you go and when NSX or Cisco ACI team goes and forms partnerships, they go on top of ACI or on top of NSX or other SDN platforms do the same sort of thing. And what Arista's done, and I've just, there's a really good graph here, is they said, look, we've changed our devices to support streaming telemetry using NetConf and gRPC. Great. And then we've got this particular product which uses our NetDB or their multi-device version of SysDB. And then from NetDB or their cloud, that's their cloud vision strategy, you can now stream that telemetry off to a telemetry app. We've written a telemetry app, but if you want to use Grafana or you want to use some other telemetry app, knock yourself out. So if you want the one throat to choke, you can go and buy Arista's telemetry platform. And then maybe as your skills develop and your in-house development capability grows over time, you can start to deploy some Grafana and say, I want to monitor just this one thing. Or maybe I want to start building new dashboards that don't exist in Arista. Or maybe I want to integrate my network monitoring with other platforms that are being used by the DevOps. You know, whatever the purpose is, Arista's not sort of shutting you down. Whereas other platforms say, yeah, we're open, but they're only open above the line. That is, their APIs northbound are open, but everything southbound is much more closed. You know, it might be quasi-open or it might look kind of open, but it's actually, you know, sealed. You really can't get in there and break it apart. That was the first thing that struck me about it. Did you see that when you read the briefing or have you looked at it?
I did. I read it. I edited it and I posted it. So yes, I'm familiar with what you said.
Okay. I also, just another point is, I'm always struck by how fast HTML5 or web apps are growing. Like once upon a time, the amount of programming companies would have had to just put into creating a GUI to show this sort of data. And yet now we have these web browsers, which is just, you know, super amazing, really, that how far web has come in the last 5 years of being able to create dashboards that have meaningful information. The more you see these demos and the data and the, you know, the charts and the graphs and the 3D visualizations, you think, you know, really that there's, you know, the old days of using, there's the Windows client and that was for Windows 95. And then there was a, you know, custom clients and all the software time that companies would have put into them. Now it's all just web and that's fantastic. The third thing about it is I've said before on other parts of Packet Pushers Network in shows that we've done on the weekly show and the priority queue is that visibility and telemetry are absolutely key to the future of networking. And I've been saying that I think we'll see a lot more of it. And we saw Cisco Tetration a few weeks ago, which is kind of like the ultimate, I think. It's just such an all-encompassing visual type of capability that, you know, that's that solution. Whereas this telemetry is a much more practical, it's like a replacement to SNMP. So most solutions like this, you poll. So you go and poll data from SNMP. The way that the Arista works is a classic telemetry approach. Well, classic, it's what we now think of as telemetry. You go into the device, you tell it, if this happens, stream this data or to stream data from this. So, you know, tell me the fan speed at 3-minute intervals and then it will send the records to you. It's not a poll, it's a send. The device sends it to you. So this is like the real insight into the future. So you might want to go and have a poke and a prod at it to see what the network monitoring systems of the future look like. It's really quite good.
Yeah, let me ask you, telemetry is kind of the new hotness. Lots of incumbents and startups are talking about providing telemetry. Is telemetry just sort of a rebranding of monitoring, or is there something more here?
No, the real key is what that last point I just made, where monitoring is usually I reach out and get some data and bring it back. So if I'm monitoring an interface, every 5 minutes I reach out and pull some statistics off the from the register, from the internal register on the box. The way telemetry works is it says you go to the box, you configure it, and you say, send me the utilization of the interface every 30 seconds. And there's some fundamental accuracies here. Like we could talk about SNMP's accuracy, which is not very accurate in very short time frames, but is also the load on the box. So there's when you poll, you have to say, give me this data, and then the box goes and gets the data, and then it packages it up and sends it to you. Whereas if you've got something that says, I need to send all of this telemetry and I can predict what it's going to do in the next 5, 10, 15 seconds, then I can schedule all these jobs and reduce the workload on the box. So it's just a much more efficient way to go. That's how it's been described to me anyway. So telemetry then is a much richer data sources. Up until now, we've had SNMP, but SNMP has been very restricted in terms of the data that you can get. The data you get from the box is actually, it's always a number or a text field, and that's pretty much it. Telemetry is much richer in terms of you can configure it to send this, you can not configure it to send this. You can, the biggest challenge in telemetry is actually turning stuff off because you get too much data. If you've got too much data, you've got a big problem at that point. So, I think keep in mind too that you've also now got access to metadata. So the key thing is here, like that Arista has VM tracer, MapReduce tracer, and container tracers. So that's where the Arista EOS is able to integrate with the controller platforms for servers. So in the case of VM tracer, it talks to VMware's vCenter. In the case of container tracer, it goes and talks to the Docker controller. And it can then say, you can go and say, well, what's connected to this port? And the box will go and talk to these other software controllers in the network and then come back and say, oh, well, on this port is these VMs or on this port is these containers. So you can trace where the container is in the physical network with a minimum of effort. You don't have to sort of go, well, what's the MAC address of the container? It's like blah, blah, and then track it and then do a MAC, blah, blah, blah. Right now, that's not right. But these, they do all that work for you. So telemetry also means that the box, you get access to this in Arista's EOS, and I'm sure other telemetry solutions will do the same. So now you're starting to say, this server name has this IP address with this MAC address. This server has these applications because my application controller deployed them there. Now you can say into your network telemetry, watch this application. And even though the machine moves around, the VM moves around the network or the containers get up and torn down, you can look forward to a vision of tracking applications in a telemetry system, which you've never been able to do before. You've always just been able to say, match this IP address or this IP address, this port number, and hope that's where the application was working.
So richness and visibility, that's a good thing.
Yes. And, the underlying point here is the better the visibility, the more you can go back to the business and say, this is what the network's doing. Because today we look fairly stupid in networking because we go, I don't know, I've got no visibility. I'll ping it. Or I'll do a trace route, see how that works. Or I'll go to my SNMP console, which is which is only polling once every 5 minutes. And if something happened for 30 seconds, you probably won't even know. And so now, as the network gets more, business gets more whatever it is about, a 30-second outage isn't acceptable. But 20 years ago, a 30-second outage was regarded as, that's not too bad. That's pretty good. So today, a 30-second outage, the end of the world's probably happened and you could be up in front of the boss for a problem. So, yeah, good stuff. Well done, Arista. I think it's done good and it's going to develop over time. And like I said, the openness is what I appreciated about this.
All right, well, we'll have the link to Greg's blog in the show notes if you want to go check it out or just look on packetpushers.net. We're going to stick with Arista for a minute. There's been a patent infringement case that Cisco brought against Arista. It's been going on for a long time. It's continuing to proceed at a glacial pace. We've got the latest update. Reuters is reporting that the U.S. International Trade Commission has approved an import ban on Arista's Ethernet switches, and that was effective August 23rd. Cisco's general counsel, Mark Chandler, blogged about it, and he quoted, "If Arista does not change its course, Cisco will bring an enforcement action in the ITC later this week." That's this week that we're recording, and as of our recording time, I haven't seen anything about that, but presumably it's going to happen because Reuters is also reporting that Arista says, we're in compliance with the ITC orders, so I'm presuming it's business as usual at Arista. They're going to continue to sell products. Lawyers are just going to have to keep hashing it out.
Yeah, so remember that Cisco brought two separate court cases here. One is in the International Trade Commission, and the other one is in the U.S. patent courts. The International Trade Commission is the body in the U.S. that prevents the importing of products if they transgress a patent. If it's a patent violation, you can prevent them from being imported to the U.S. So this is U.S. specific only. Now, the reason that Cisco's chasing after Arista is, as I discovered this week, Arista published a chart in their financial reports, and they basically showed that their 12% market share in high-speed data center, when I say high-speed, that means 10 gig and 40 gig, because that's what Arista's market is focused on. So they've gained a 12% market share in that small part of the market, that high end of the market, and Cisco shrunk from 73% to 60%. Now, if that's true, and you know they've presented that to the SEC, so you have to assume that it is true, you can see why Cisco is very concerned, because Arista is taking market share away in the next generation of Ethernet, the 10 gig, 40 gig.
10, 40, 100, yeah.
Yeah, the 10, 25, 50, 100. Arista's already there and growing rapidly. So I think we've said several times, I've said on this show, I've never really understood why Cisco is so aggressively pursuing Arista. What, I mean, what's to win, right? You know, for the downside, you know, executive time is wasted. It costs money to pursue the lawsuits. People are distracted by this. It doesn't, you know, and it's not very good PR that Cisco is sort of bashing up on Arista. I don't think customers see anybody coming out of this. Well, Cisco's got the big company beating up on the little company. Of course, Arista's got reputational damage associated with it. So I'm not 100% sure who wins, but if this is, you know, this chart shows that Arista's growing strongly, Cisco's shrinking in the market that Arista's competing in. So maybe it's doing this to protect its market share. Now, that said, that's why they're doing it. This is now clear. I think it's well understood what motivates Cisco in this place. They're losing. They haven't been able to compete on product or price, and so they're using the courts. Perfectly acceptable. I make no opinions about that. Arista now has said that they're now moving to make the parts or to use source the components locally, so the ITC order doesn't prevent them, so they'll continue to sell them as normal. And where possible, they're actually removing those things from their products. So there was a PVLAN, private VLAN functionality, which Cisco claims is their proprietary solution. And so they've just removed that feature from their switches. And off you go. No big deal. And it only applies to the US, although the US is a very big market. Five of the Super 7 data center providers are in the US, a US company, so it does have some impact on Arista. What's the long-term impact? Who knows? The share price fell by 2 or 3% for a couple of hours, and now it's actually back up to and higher than it was before. So we'll see.
I wonder if there's a curious effect that if the market sees Cisco going at Arista, you know, through the courts, that that's a sign that Arista is doing something right in the market. And so that would attract more Wall Street praise for Arista.
Yeah. You know, I think the legal case is always playing with a live hand grenade. It
sure.
can go either way. And until the hand grenade's gone off, you don't know who's holding the hand grenade. Cisco could lose in the patent courts and they'd be left with Arista saying, yeah, we were right all along, so there, and seeking damages and whatever. Or it can go the other way, and I think it's a bit of a punt. I think Cisco knows that if this trend continues, they're going to be in trouble because Arista's sort of stealing their future. Arista is successful, so one way to hobble their business or slow them down so that Cisco can react is to take them to court.
Sure. Although it's interesting also from a PR perspective that Cisco, all the blogs that come out from Cisco, they take sort of the position of an aggrieved organization, and they're just advocating for fairness in the market. And, you know, our actions are protecting intellectual property, which is great for everyone because intellectual property should be protected. Meanwhile, Arista is saying nothing. They're dead silent. They're just kind of moving through this, trying to work it out. And two interesting approaches to fighting this in a public relations front.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, Cisco is being very in your face. And the blog posts don't read very well. Whoever's writing them is sort of, you know, going na 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 sort of. It doesn't seem to make sense to blog them, and you know, they don't read well from a customer point of view, in my view. I've asked a few people, and they said basically nobody comes out of this looking well. Customers are concerned either way, but they're also concerned that Cisco's going to start bashing up on, you know, other people in the market, and that's not a good thing either.
Okay, well, speaking of Cisco bashing other people in the market, the Register is reporting that Cisco has apparently removed Nutanix from its solution partner program. This is in response to Nutanix independently certifying its software to run on Cisco UCSC servers.
Nutanix has a longstanding reputation as being a little silly sometimes. And this, do you know what I mean?
That aggressive, maybe?
Yeah, they're very aggressive. They're very hard charging. They tend to hire people who have an overinflated sense of their importance in the universe. And they probably have overreached themselves here. I think we said last week, I thought Cisco, you know, the sort of way I read their announcement was, we've worked with Cisco to approve our software on Cisco's UCS. As it turns out, they've self-certified them to run on UCS, and Cisco is not at all happy about this because
no.
They don't want to be seen as endorsing a competitive product, because Nutanix software is directly competitive to HyperFlex. And, you know, we've talked a lot of the time about how Cisco doesn't want to compete against people. It keeps chasing after partnerships with companies. So I don't understand why they wouldn't partner with Nutanix and just say, sure, if you want to bring your software onto our hardware, that's fine. If customers want to buy our UCS software but not our HyperFlex, that should be okay, because guess what happens in people's networks, you know? They go and buy third-party firewalls. They go and buy third-party lots of things. So I'm not 100% sure why Cisco would suddenly shut down on HyperFlex and say, no, HyperFlex is the only hyperconverged strategy on UCS. At the same time, there are other hyperconverged strategies that are viable on UCS, right? There's Scale and a couple of others. I can't think of their names off the top of my head. So maybe I think Nutanix is just like, you're not actually being very grown up about this. Why didn't you come and talk to us? Why aren't you being a partner? Oh, well, if you're going to be like that, bye. Have a nice day. And those partner programs actually matter.
Well, that's what I'm wondering, does Cisco have sufficient clout with the partners that it can essentially quash any Nutanix UCS sales?
Well, there's a lot of people out there who like Cisco's UCS servers. Although Cisco has a 12% or so market share in the server market, people who like UCS, I think server people get very loyal to a particular brand because they're very painful to do. These blade servers and these, you know, highly customized NICs, these fancy NICs do require a fair bit of effort to make them run. You get very attached to what you know. You know, there's a cognitive disorder called cognitive ease. And literally that which you know and you trust, even though it's not trustable and not very well known or not whatever, right? You know, when you listen to a song and you've heard it 100 times before and you like it and you get comfortable with the song. So when you hear the song, you know what it is. That's called cognitive ease. So that which you know, you judge as being better or more valuable because you know it, not because it is inherently valuable or known. So people who like Cisco UCS or HP Blades or Dell servers or whatever it is are very fond and they want everything else to run on those particular servers. So now Nutanix has to get customers to not only buy hyperconverged and buy their software, and they now have to get customers to buy their hardware as well. And a lot of customers don't want to run Cisco UCS over here and Nutanix hardware over there. They want to run the same server everywhere.
Sure, that makes sense.
But the people involved want to buy whatever they want to buy because it's just they're just being lazy mostly. I don't know why they just don't go and buy somebody else's x86 servers in 1RU form factors and be done with it. Why buy all these blade servers or custom servers? I really don't understand it.
Well, I guess Cisco's counting on customers ending up siding with. So if they're a UCS customer, then I guess Cisco's banking on the fact that we can shunt them toward HyperFlex. Nutanix's popularity be damned.
Yes, I suspect so. Yes, they would much rather sell HyperFlex and take all the money. Arguably, Cisco is really big. You know, I haven't seen a sort of really heavy marketing push around HyperFlex, and none of the resellers are sort of pushing back on it. I think they're holding fire. Like after Cisco's previous failures around Invicta, and they've sort of dabbled with everybody's hyperconverged, and I get the sense that the resellers are sort of going, you know, and then the ACI took so long to sort of, I think a lot of resellers are going, okay, fine, just give us a chance. We'll be there with you in a bit. We'll be with you shortly. That's where I think it is right now.
All right, sticking with Cisco, here's a story in which Cisco isn't angry at another technology company, and that's its good buddy Apple. If you remember, in June of this year, Apple announced that its forthcoming iOS 10 operating system would integrate with Cisco voice and video equipment to create a quote-unquote fast lane for business traffic on Apple mobile devices. And then a Cisco blog this week hinted at other functionality that's going to be coming out tied into this, including integration for Bluetooth headsets and Cisco Spark. And Cisco Spark is that company's collaboration platform. And then automatically connecting calls via Spark between users in the same corporate directory.
Yeah, so this is an announcement from 6 months ago or 8 months ago. We talked about it. I was trying to work out what it meant back then, where they said that Cisco will work with Apple to make sure Apple products work best on Cisco wireless. And they're now saying that that's been delivered. And in iOS 10, it will be out. The blog post is fairly blunt. It just says optimized iPhone and iPad communication on a Cisco network. That is, your iPhone or iPad must support some sort of extensions that make Cisco wireless do better. I must go and try and dig into the technology behind that. But apparently this makes the performance of your apps, especially real-time apps like voice and video, much more reliable. A fast lane for business critical apps, so Cisco WebEx or Cisco Spark, will apparently work better on the iPhone itself. So if you're running those apps, and making a big deal about Cisco Spark again because it's actually optimized for iPhone and iPad as opposed to Android. What are you saying? It doesn't work on Android? I don't know. And then generally better. So I think maybe Cisco's gone to Apple and said, could you please do some cross-handling of these and do some stuff with our software to make it run better so that we get a position in the market. And of course, Apple wants to get into the enterprise. So partnering to Cisco makes sense. Yeah, whatever. I think it's great.
Yeah, I mean, Cisco does seem intent on shoehorning Spark into this sort of deal, but I agree it's a smart partnership for both of them. Apple needs to be enterprise-friendly, and Cisco benefits if it has stronger ties into Apple's gear, that the smartphones and tablets, because it's so popular and people just bring it into work.
Yeah, like I said, I think Slack has probably got critical momentum here, and I would suspect that over time, Spark will go the way of WebEx and other things. WebEx hasn't exactly won the war in terms of desktop conferencing, and it works well for some people, but it's not a pinch hit winner. There are others, and Slack is way bigger than Cisco Spark already. So, and Spark's pretty pricey. So we'll see what works out in the long run.
Right. But it's there. If you want it, if it's there.
Yeah, the general consensus is that it's pricey, but it's not particularly better. So if it's going to be pricey, it needs to be better. Pricey better.
Well, again, this seems to fit into the whole narrative of if you like Cisco and you're on board, then you'll do it the Cisco way, and Spark is the Cisco way.
Sure. And, you know, the ability to integrate Spark with your WAN and stuff, there's a sort of a story there. But, you know, guess what you do 90% of the time? You're using it over the internet. I'm not 100% sure what the benefits are.
All right. Well, we'll leave that there. Going to take a moment to thank one of our sponsors, CloudGenix. CloudGenix and the Packet Pushers are hosting an SD-WAN mixer at VMworld. Greg, you're going to be there. Can you tell us more about it?
Yes, we're going to VMworld. We'll be hanging around like a bad smell. But most importantly, Monday night, August the 29th, that's next Monday, probably tonight, actually, as you're listening to this, from 6 p.m. in Vegas at the MGM Grand Centrifuge Lounge. We'll be hanging around with CloudGenix to have a bit of a cocktail, some snacks, and we'll be talking about CloudGenix and SD-WAN. Come and meet us. And you can also chat to some CloudGenix people about SD-WAN and maybe get a bit more insight. But mostly, I'll be there and come along and visit us. Thanks to CloudGenix for taking the time to see us. And I'm looking forward to meeting the audience there.
That's right. And they're also going to have the I Want CloudGenix Challenge station set up. That's where you can actually try and do some provisioning of SD-WAN with CloudGenix, get your hands on it, play around with it. And maybe Greg will say rude things to you while you're trying to get it set up. There's going to be t-shirts and giveaways, free drinks and food. And so if you're interested, please go to cloudgenix.com to register. You do have to register for this event. You don't want to miss it. So head on over to cloudgenix.com to register. And thank you, CloudGenix. All right, jumping back to the news, you got a briefing from Telari Networks.
Yeah, Telari Networks, SD-WAN vendor. They gave me a briefing. It was a couple of weeks back. I'm a bit slow because of the travel and catching up with stuff. Telari Networks, of course, is an SD-WAN vendor. They've sponsored a couple of shows on Packet Pushers. They gave me a briefing on the latest changes. A couple of things that I wanted to draw to your attention. One is they're expanding their products to embrace managed service providers. Managed service providers are a very popular way of managing wide area networks. A lot of companies don't do them themselves. They outsource them to an MSP, often an MSP that's a part of a bigger carrier like Verizon or BT or Telstra. And a lot of those MSPs are looking at software-defined WAN products as a way to overhaul their solution offering. So instead of using dedicated routers, they're actually starting to say, maybe we should do it. So Telari Networks is shifting their product to embrace that emerging market. Two, they're building partnerships with other companies. We've heard this before across the industry. So they're dealing, you know, Palo Alto Networks, VMware, Exynda, and Amazon have come together to allow Telari Networks to partner and then go forward on deals with customers. I think you're going to hear a lot more of this partnership story going forward. Now that we've got APIs and integrations left and right, partnerships are going to be the wheel of the day. I'm still very cynical about them, but let's take it on faith. And they've got some new features in their product, which I quite liked. I've picked out just three. They now do speed tests on paths. They call this their active bandwidth feature. So if you've got a path and you want to check that the speed is still there, you can schedule a speed test between two Telari devices to actually validate that the bandwidth is there. So it hasn't been taken away by the carrier, which does happen. Secondly, they are introducing a standby WAN links. So they're now putting, you might have two or three or four connections. And what you might want to have is have three WAN connections active and a fourth on active standby. That's the functionality there. And they also put heartbeats down the fourth connection. So it's not a cold standby, it's a hot standby. It's actually being tested. You know it works. And finally, firewalls. They've implemented a zone-based firewalling feature, which allows you to extend your security features right out to the edge. Now, these features are all in various of the other SD-WAN products too, but I just wanted to bring to attention that Telari Networks has that in their next version of code, which I think is shipping around about now, August or September?
I do not know, but it is August, so it could be then.
Yeah, so soon.
All right, very good. We also have some news from PlumGrid. PlumGrid is an SDN and NFV solution for data centers, and they're launching a new cloud secure option to fortify containers and OpenStack clouds.
Yeah, this is a bit of a there's a key thing here. One is that they're announcing a virtual tap functionality. So Those of you who've listened to podcasts with Big Switch on the show are using their Big Tap solution. So literally, you know, you can use their hardware capability to duplicate flows and then tap them off using virtual tap solution. PlumGrid is using their software functionality to implement the same thing, so virtual taps, and this allows you to redirect trap flows over to other. So that's the new feature that they're announcing here. And then what they've done is called Cloud Secure as an initiative, which is a bunch of other standard features of an SDN platform, that is micro-segmentation, security policies, firewalls at the edge, NFV/service function chaining, so service insertion, and you can also encrypt some of those overlays if you've got enough CPU in your network. So bundling all that together, they're now calling that their cloud secure networking, which is the way of the future. But the big news is that PlumGrid now supports virtual tap interfaces.
And they're also partnering with some well-known security companies to provide virtualized security services. So if you need to, for instance, spin up some kind of security function in a container or in a cloud organization, PlumGrid will enable that.
Yeah, you know, it's not too hard for SDN solutions to implement this thing. So in some ways, it's good to see this emerging, but it's interesting to see PlumGrid doing it.
The other thing I know about PlumGrid is that while a lot of the virtual networking functions happen via OVS, the Open Virtual Switch, PlumGrid is actually using IOVisor instead of OVS. So something to consider if you're thinking about that.
Yeah, they use their own version of a virtual switch. They don't use Open vSwitch. They use, I can't remember, we did a show on IOVisor about 6 to 9 months ago. If you want to know more about IOVisor, go and have a listen to that.
Yeah, and as we mentioned last week about Linux Foundation, I think IOVisor is a Linux Foundation project.
It is now, yes. So it was originally PlumGrid, and then they put it into, set it up as an open source, and now it's moved into the Linux Foundation. There's 4 virtual switches that I know of off the top of my head. This is one of them.
That's right. The Open Virtual Switch, Open vSwitch, is also now recently a Linux Foundation project as well, so strange bedfellows.
And we did a show with Cisco talking about their FD.io based on their VPP virtual switching technology. And that was also targeted for a Linux Foundation in the longer run. Not there yet, I don't believe. So, yes, you too can choose your virtual switch. Pick your favorite.
All right, sticking with private cloud, a startup called ZeroStack, they make private cloud software for enterprises based on OpenStack. They've announced that they will now have support for Dell and HPE hardware. They're hoping to gain some traction among resellers by being available on converged storage and servers from these brand name providers.
Yeah, so the idea that doing OpenStack yourself is too hard seems to be incredibly popular, and everybody wants to buy an OpenStack distribution from somebody. Well, if you're going to buy an OpenStack distribution, you probably run it on hardware, and if you want to de-risk your first version, you probably want to run it on blessed hardware. So the secret engineers have incanted across the top of these boxes and decided that this works.
They've sacrificed some chickens and waved some incense around and...
That's right. Sprinkle it with, you know, silicon chips and, you know, whatever. Wrap it in cables and, you know, whatever. Whatever. It does. In real world, this actually matters. So, you know, the idea of being able to take an off-the-shelf OpenStack guaranteed to work on known good hardware takes away a lot of perceived risk in buying these solutions. And it is a lot of work to get an OpenStack going. There's so much to, you know, so much to climb that I understand why customers want to do this. But I'm not 100% sure that how many more OpenStack companies have to emerge and then die or be bought we're going to see in the next 3 or 4 years before we finally get to the point where OpenStack is like Microsoft Windows, which is a server, you know, like Microsoft Server or Linux as a server, and we're all just okay with it.
Right. I think, you know, obviously ZeroStack is one of those entrants, and it's good for them to be on Dell and HPE because it is so hard to get OpenStack up and running and organizations are taking a chance. So having certified hardware is good, but you're right that there is... still a lot of work for OpenStack to become more accepted on the private cloud side.
OpenStack is getting easier. It's getting better all the time, but it's not that much better. It's still a little painful.
And that may be a discussion we'll come back to later in the show. But first, I want to thank Nuage Networks, one of our other sponsors for today. Organizations like yours are well on their way to taking full advantage of the cloud for ubiquitous agile connectivity across remote sites. But as those networks get bigger and more complex, a new challenge moves to the front of the line: security. If protecting your sensitive data and key applications in multi-tenant clouds is keeping you up at night, talk to the experts at Nuage Networks. They'll tell you how to provide a secure multi-tenant environment and still roll out new services as the pace users demand. They'll show you a solution that's flexible as it is robust, and it supports the particular policy-based requirements of different traffic while providing for elastic scale-out of additional security services as new capacity comes online. With a secure, software-defined networking solution from Nuage Networks, you'll have the most trusted cloud services available, so you can speed up your cloud deployments and deliver new services on demand, all with peace of mind. please visit nuagenetworks.net and join the cloud conversation on Twitter using @nuagenetworks. And back to the news, Citrix just released free load balancing software. This is aimed at developers who are building container-based applications and microservices. The software is called CPX Express. It's purpose-built for the container environment. Citrix is hoping developers are going to use it instead of the open source option like HAProxy.
Load balancers, you know, where do we go from here? HAProxy is very popular with developers because you can DevOps the heck out of it. And more importantly, it's all over Hacker News or, you know, one of those sites. It's easy to get advice on that. So having these free versions is very useful for developers so that they can easily get things up and running, and then you have a different one for production. Now, certainly commercial load balancers have more functions and capabilities, but that's not always the consideration in the development cycle. So I do like Citrix load balancers. I think they have a lot of features. They're very powerful. They've always been software only in a way, and so they're well suited to the software environment. And I do think people should have a look at it. I'm also hoping from a certification and familiarity process. So these days, you want to be able to just spin one up and have a play with it to make sure that you know what you're doing. You can't afford to be making changes on live environments with these highly complex products. And having access to a free one will be very good for those people who want to be able to test and trial and validate the changes that they're going to do before they go live.
Right. I talked to Citrix about this, and they said their goal for this was to make it as frictionless as possible to get. So it's essentially you go to the website, you fill out 3 fields, and you get the software. That's it. It's license free, but it is not open source, just in case that's an issue for you. Not open source, but it is free to use and start playing with. It does have a limited feature set from their wider load balancing software, CPX, which is also container-based. But they're definitely going hard after developers with this.
And so they should, because they're the people who are implementing load balancers. Up until now, that networking people put load balancers in after the development experience. And it's really going to be the reverse of that going forward.
Yeah, well, that's why they're doing this. They're hoping that if developers come on board with CPX Express, then maybe the operation side is going to be like, well, developers are using this, we'll go buy the licensed version, and then we'll be all good. We also talked about this in our last episode, Martin Casado making comments about how developers are actually like really disrupting the sales process for these big vendors. This Citrix release, I think, is a real proof point for that argument. They can't just sell to IT anymore. They have to go after lines of businesses within enterprises that have these DevOps teams spinning up these applications.
Yeah, well, the DevOps people are the ones who are actually buying the load balancers or putting them into their pilots and then all of a sudden handing them off. Maybe the networking people don't even know the load balancer's there because it'll be deployed via Ansible or, you know, Puppet or Chef. You know, they might suddenly be told that there's a problem with the load balancer and they're going like, what load balancer?
Didn't tell us about the load balancer.
Yeah, that's right. We weren't involved. We didn't know. And yeah, that's true. The developers for some – and but this is also the micro-segmentation thing. You know, we talk a lot about micro-segmentation in terms of software-defined networking, but you also have micro-segmentation of your network functions, that is your load balancers and firewalls. I would expect over time that where developers are writing apps, they'll create their own firewalls and their own load balancers. And what you want to say is if you're going to use a firewall, use this brand. And instead of having one big firewall at the front of your data center, you'll have 20 or 30 of them, one for each application, and it'll be software. And that's a different thing that's coming out in the future.
All right. Well, good job, Citrix. Greg, you and Ethan were at the Intel Developer Forum in San Francisco recently. We talked last week in last week's episode about some of the initiatives coming out of Intel, and there were a couple that you didn't get to last week, so you wanted to round that off.
Yeah, the big one I wanted to talk about was Intel's push around 5G. Now, I didn't quite understand for a while why Intel would be big on 5G, and I sat through a session called Virtual Remote Radio Access Networks. And what they've actually done is all the functions that go into the base station of a mobile phone tower for 5G, they demonstrated a virtual RAN network and VMs. So they built the whole radio access network. So all the software functions that are in the radio access network, they've built a bunch of x86 servers. They're running OpenStack using the Wind River Linux OS. Wind River Linux is a type of a Linux that's optimized for telcos, highly stable, very, very fast, very reliable. It's called a telco version of the Linux. And then inside of that, they've actually put all of the functions that you need to run the radios, to run the applications. So things like the remote radio heads, the CPRIs, the hardware platforms, even the first versions of 5G hardware will be using FPGAs. That is, because the 5G standards are iterating very quickly, we don't know what they're going to look like in the long run. They can't get into building ASICs. So they're going to build the first generation of 5G hardware in FPGAs. And those FPGAs are going to run things like fast Fourier transforms on the radio signals to be able to decode them and stuff like that, right? So the radio signal will be received by a physical piece of kit, it'll come off as a digitized signal, and then it'll be fed into FPGAs doing FFTs to decode, you know, or mathematics to basically decode the radio signal from the digital into analog and blah, blah, blah. So what they're showing is that all of this is an OpenStack private cloud. And that's Intel's interest, of course, because every time there's a private cloud, there's x86 CPUs, x86 there's motherboards.
Is there, yes.
There's servers, there's things, right? So they've invested, you know, big money here to build a functionally working solution. And they call it FlexRAN, which is quite useful. And, you know, I think I talked last week about 5G and how, you know, we're going to see 5G as a big part of the IoT push. This, you know, both the low power, high latency. So, you know, coin size sensors with batteries that run for 10 years. Then we're going to have the ability to provide differentiated services. So the carriers today on, you know, 3G, it's like everybody has a fair go at equal access to bandwidth. In 5G, they're looking to develop standards which allow low latency, low performance, low latency, high performance, guaranteed bandwidth. So if people are willing to pay for extra bandwidth, they can give them get service guarantees. As well as having very high speed, there's another part to the 5G, which is for mobile broadband. You know, the idea of having gigabit to the to the home. So using 5G as a cable replacement technology, especially in high-rise buildings. And then there's also things for small cells. So the idea is that today in a high-rise building, you can put a base station down on the ground, but if you're in a 50-story building, getting your mobile signal to the 50th floor, not so hot. So there's a whole bunch of stuff in 5G that's coming down, and Intel sees a lot of those things in 5G as being software-driven, and they want to make sure that their hardware is a part of that software evolution. And so I took away a very strong message there that the next generation of private clouds won't actually be in the enterprise. They're going to be in the service provider, and they're actually going to be in the mobile base station.
So does this mean Intel is going to start competing with other companies that are selling the gear to run mobile base stations, like a Nokia, an Alcatel, a Huawei?
Well, those companies are already producing those hardware solutions. So Nokia has something called its Air platform, has a fancy name for it. Ericsson has its servers. Fujitsu's got a set of service provider grade server platforms. HPE's got a very large division selling servers to carriers and service providers. And Intel wants to make sure that its hardware is a part of that strategy so that service providers are looking at examples of, you can do all this in a VM on an OpenStack. And you could do all of this just using Intel's, not just, but, you know, using Intel servers. Why would you go and buy custom hardware from other people? Why don't you create a private cloud and do this way?
Right.
And they're committing resources to show that this can be done. And they actually demonstrated this, you know, FlexRAN, this virtual RAN head end, and gave a speech about it. So, yeah, 5G is going to be radically different. It's not about private clouds. It's about changing the way that mobile telephony and mobile networking completely works.
And just as a little promotional note from our end, you actually sat down with some folks at Intel to talk about 5G, and we'll have a podcast about that in the Priority Queue feed.
That's right. There'll be a Priority Queue podcast coming out next week or this week, today even?
Probably tomorrow, today, yeah.
Yeah, well, today's Thursday the 25th as we record this.
I had to time switch this.
There's a bit of a time switch.
By the time you hear this, the podcast will be available.
Yeah, if you want to hear more, we did a 40-minute podcast with one of the executives, Carolyn Chan, on 5G and how it works, a much more deeper dive than I can put into this show.
All right, our last story for today, I found a blog from JP Morgenthal. He's a cloud pundit, called Everyone's Moving Everything to the Cloud. It's more of he's sort of pulled a whole bunch of cloud thinkers, cloud pundits to get their take on this debate about, is private infrastructure going to go away and everything is going to move up to the cloud or not? Unfortunately, the only real consensus that emerged is that it's complicated. In other words, some folks see that, yes, everything's going to go to the public cloud, and others say, no, there's plenty of good reasons to keep some applications and workloads and operations in-house.
Yeah, you know, that's not new. I'm not sure why you had to ask cloud pundits to get that opinion, but there you go. I'm trying to think, in particular, there was a blog post that I'll try and find the link to, where basically there are people moving from private to public. There's a lot of people moving from public back to private. There are people moving from private to SaaS. There are people moving from static or legacy data centers to private. And I basically, and I think, you know, as we've just talked about in the last article, there's emerging new private clouds in new places. There's another one in factories. So factories are going to go from today having a few hundred sensors on a production line to thousands of sensors per production line. And you're not going, because you have to evaluate that data very fast and react very quickly, you can't ship that off to the cloud to make those decisions. The cloud may be a part of that model for long-term analysis or machine learning or deep artificial intelligence or something, But on the spot, you're going to build a private cloud that's going to pull all that data together and munge it and react to it. And so I think there's going to be as many new private clouds that public cloud pundits haven't actually thought of because they're so focused on the public cloud, but also that there are an infinite spectrum of cloud initiatives that go different ways. So some people are going to move holus bolus and then going to overcome the data gravity and move all their data into the cloud. And guess what? They're going to be nailed to the floor because wherever your data is, that's where your compute and network goes. So that's where your compute and network goes always.
And also your money. And that's where your money goes.
Well, yes, that's right. And, you know, public cloud is very expensive today. People say that's because there's too much demand, but they don't have to make it cheaper. I say because public cloud is always expensive. It's always going to be expensive. But anyway, neither here nor there. You're also going to see people say, my data's here. It's in this place. The pain and cost of moving it to that place is too high. So I'm just going to I'll build a private cloud because that makes sense. And you're going to see other people embrace the private SaaS offering. So the classic one is Office 365. People are moving their Microsoft Exchange servers and moving their email to Microsoft, and that frees them up to do other things with their in-house. So yeah, this isn't new. I've been saying this for 3 or 4 years, I think.
I think J.P. Morgenthau wrote this blog because in response to a blog from Bernard Golden, which I think we talked about in a previous show, who essentially is predicting the long, slow decline of private clouds. And so this was an attempt to sort of gauge the community at large and take the temperature on that.
Yeah, well, yes. So private clouds, as you know them today, are going to decline. It is, for a lot of people, better to go and use public clouds. But there are new private clouds coming. There are going to be factories that don't currently use technology, x86 technology at all. There are carriers who use these weird custom boxes. That's a whole new generation of private clouds that are coming. There are new private clouds coming for the enterprise data center, right? So this has always been easily predictable. So making a dumbass prediction like everybody's going to be in the public cloud, that was like 5 years ago when we were enormously excited about the fact that people could make compute scale and we could use software to do it. And oh my, this is just so much better than doing it manually. Everybody knows that now. The reality is public cloud's expensive. Public cloud is hard. Public cloud is difficult to use. You have to overcome an awful lot of pain to be able to do it. And unless you're starting from zero, you're not going to go from where you are to where you're going there without an enormous investment in time and resources. So that's really all of these articles. This is the fourth or fifth one of these I've seen this year. So it's not new.
My own opinion is that technologies rarely go away. So I always tend to take the approach that we'll have some of all. So I'm with you. And maybe, Greg, you've just earned your cloud pundit stripes. I don't know.
I've achieved and pundited a nation.
That's right. Ding, there's your badge.
There's your badge. Yeah, we still have mainframes. Remember them?
That's right.
You know, so it's like, yeah, sure. Everybody's moving to the cloud just as soon as we finish having mainframes and minis and dedicated servers and blah, blah, blah.
That's right. Yes. I mean, I think about it in other technology areas. I go in my car and I still have a radio that wouldn't have been out of place 60 years ago. So.
Still works too.
Still works.
There's still AM radio stations, for goodness sakes.
All right. Well, that brings us to the end of this punditry session. Greg, if folks want to get more from you, where can they get it?
If I'm on my blog at Ethereal Mind, on the Twitters is at Ethereal Mind. And if you're at VMworld next week, tweet at me. Love to catch up with you. If you want to see me around, I'll be recording some podcasts called Engineers at the Bar. That's fairly descriptive of what they'll be. And you'll find them on the community channel. The community channel of the Packet Pushers doesn't actually come in the fat pipe or any of the other feeds. You have to go and subscribe to it explicitly. Get on over to Packet Pushers to find more on that.
All right. I'm Drew Conry Murray. I blog at packetpushers.net. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Drew_CM. Thank you to our sponsors, CloudGenix and Nuage Networks, and see our website for links to learn more about them. And thank you for joining us for another episode of Network Break. If you enjoy the show, give us a like on Facebook, leave a recommendation on iTunes, or share a link with your friends. And please check out our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. You can find out how to subscribe at packetpushers.net. Thanks for listening.